Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, May 7, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FranStorchND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So, I'm doing pretty good today, and not too much to report. My knee's pretty good. I'm not shaking. I'm off my Lyme meds except for adaptogens and one neurological herb, kudzu, and otherwise I'm doing pretty good. And energy's not too bad either. I seem to have recovered from the excess fatigue from that cold. Ron is still, he's researching madly because he was diagnosed with spinal stenosis in his neck, so we're going to try and figure out next steps for that. And we'll have, the next time I come on, I'll be with Ron so he can describe what's going on a little bit better. And so what I wanted to talk about first was the fact that, you know, when I'm recording this, we're still in this April, May up and down weather that, and I saw a very funny meme about one day, on Sunday, you're wearing a wool coat and you know, heavy pants, and the next day you're wearing a tank top and shorts, and the next day you're wearing lighter long pants and a long sleeve shirt. Next day you're back to snow, and the weather's just been really up and down. So I think that's affecting a lot of people's health and mood, and I just wanted to put out there, if you can allow yourself to be resilient and accept whatever the weather is doing on a given day, that you might be a little bit happier. Now, if you can't do this, it's okay. I'm just going to make this as a suggestion. It's what I do, and I don't pretend that this is what everybody is going to be able to do. But what I do is I follow the weather. I like to watch Alexis Clemens and Bob Maxson on NBC and all the other Anthony Carpino and all those nice guys and Ryan Hanrahan over at NBC, and I follow the weather there. And I also have apps. I like to use WeatherBug and I like to use Weather Underground. And I have something that's attached to my Google phone that's weather as well. So I follow the weather, and then I just plan for whatever the weather is going to do. So today I'm making this recording, and it happens to be a yucky day. And I don't know if you remember a few weeks ago when it was April, and people woke up to snow on the ground in various places in New England. We did not in Mansfield Center, but if you were at any kind of elevation, by elevation I mean stores. So stores is sitting at 600-700 feet, depending where you are. Same with Tallinn, which is 700-800 feet. They had snow on the ground. Bolton Notch had snow on the ground. So there's all these photos of people with snow on the ground. And so that made me quote the song Evergreen. Remember a long time ago, was it the 70s or the 80s when that movie came out with Barbara Streisand? There was that lovely song Evergreen. And one of the lines in the song was, like a rose under the April snow. So I was posting that on people's Facebooks, and then I posted it on my own along with the song. And I don't know if anybody got it, but anyway, it reminded me of that. You know, we have flowers. There are bluettes growing in my yard, and I saw a violet or two coming up, and some of the bulbs have already been, crocus has been coming up, and daffodils. So it's really, it can be hard to go back and forth with this kind of weather. But if you have a day where you're expecting to be outside, like it's your day off work, and then the weather's just awful, it's because today it was sleeting and snowing and raining and chilly and raw, and you didn't really want to be outside. I look forward to those days because that's a good day to sit down with a book and a cup of tea. I'm really set up. That's why I think it's important. If you want to get regular exercise, it's really important to set yourself up for exercise so that you can exercise anywhere. And I try to let people know that it's a good idea to have something you like to do that's easy to get to outside, whether that's in your yard or you go for a walk or you go for a bike ride, something that's outdoors that you enjoy doing, something that you can do inside your home. So I'm very set up for that. I'm set up in my bedroom, the TV's there, and I can access YouTube and I can do yoga there. And I can also Zoom into yoga classes. And I also have a bike trainer downstairs, so I can exercise indoors, and it's already set up, so it's very easy for me to do. There's not, clothes hanging on my bike trainer so that when I get downstairs, it's all set to go. The shoes are down there. I just have to throw in some clothes, bring my tablet so I can run my apps, and off I go. So if you're set up and ready to go, you can get exercise inside your home. You can always find a little space to do yoga, and you could do very relaxing, stretchy yoga too. In a little corner of some room. You can do it in your bedroom. You can do it in the spare room. You can do it in the living room. And you can do your own stretches from memory. And you can also use, like I said, you could take a Zoom class, or you can find things on YouTube to do. And so whatever device you have, you could do that from your phone, your laptop, or your tablet. And if you have a smart TV, you probably have YouTube on the smart TV. You can use it there. And if you have something on the tablet, but you don't have an app, the app that's related to that routine, like you have a special app that has exercise on it, then you can project it to, if you have a smart TV, you can project it. But you don't have to. A lot of people will exercise just off their phones. I have lots of patients who just use apps on their phones. So it's a great, so make sure you have stuff to do. If the weather is icky and you don't want to be outside, make sure you have things to do that you can enjoy inside. And then it's also okay to not do very much, to take the day and enjoy it and relax. That's a good time to have a cup of tea, read a book, and look forward to not having very much to do. I know for me, I'm always going, and running, having a million things to do. And when I have a day when I don't have a lot to do, that's a very nice thing. And so I try to lean into it. I didn't make plans to do a Passover Seder, to go somewhere for a Passover Seder. I could go to Glastonbury for one, but I don't think I want to go to Glastonbury because it's 40 minutes away and I'm tired and I want to rest. And I usually will Zoom in with my sister, but my sister is going somewhere this year and so is my mother. I could try to find somewhere to go, or I could just lean into it's okay to be home, and I'll do my own version of celebrating Passover. I'll, read the Haggadah myself. I'll read it to Ron. We'll have a little wine. We'll have a little special dinner, and then I'll observe the dietary rules of Passover, and I'll just do some extra reading about Passover during the week. And that'll be my observance of Passover, and it's okay. I mean, for me, having less to do is nice. Last weekend, it was stressful because I was away, and I was very tired, and I was still getting over that cold. And this weekend, I don't have very much to do, and it's great. I'm going to lean into it and enjoy it, and I suggest that you do the same, that it's okay to have some time where you're not doing stuff. It's really okay to relax, to lie around, to not accomplish stuff, especially if you're busy accomplishing stuff all week and you have many days where you're always having to get stuff done. It's really okay to have some time to not do that. Do think about that. I've been trying to pull a few things from the news before I talk about the main things I wanted to talk about for the week. So let's talk about sucralose and weight gain. So sucralose is it's a sugar substitute that's in a lot of processed foods. There's a new study that investigated how sucralose, which is a non-caloric sweetener, affects brain signals related to hunger. The researchers compared the effects of sucralose to water and sugar, with sucrose, among healthy young adults, and the findings suggest that sucralose may impact the brain in a way that could promote overeating. So here you are trying to use this non-caloric sweetener, and it can promote overeating. Surprise, surprise. So sucralose, I don't know if it tells you what sucralose is. Sucralose is interesting. It's basically sugar, but they've taken some of the hydroxyl groups. So sugar is an organic molecule, and organic molecules generally have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen in them. If they are a protein or an amino acid, they're also going to have nitrogen. And then depending what they are, they might also have other compounds like sulfur in them. But sugars generally are some variation of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And when you have organic chemistry, you have the empirical formula. The empirical formula is just how many carbons, how many hydrogens, how many oxygens are in it, just written out like that. And then you have the structural formula. So you draw the formula as the molecule is laid out in space with all of its bonds. So you can have something that has the same empirical, two compounds that have the same empirical formula, but they have a different conformation in space, so that makes them different molecules, and it makes it so that they have different properties. So sugar, sucrose, has a bunch of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen arranged in a certain way in space, and it has hydroxyl groups. So that's hydroxyl groups is an oxygen and a hydrogen bonded together, stuck onto one of the many carbons. So sucralose has some of those hydroxyl groups substituted with chlorine, so chloride. So you have a chloride instead of a hydroxyl group that goes there. So that, and that's what makes it sucralose. And because it has that chloride, it doesn't behave in your body the same way that sucrose does, that actual sugar does. So so let's look at this. About 1 in 5 adults are obese in the United States. There's so many foods and beverages marketed to people who are trying to lose weight. And scientists wonder how effective they are at satiating appetites. So there are non-caloric sweeteners like sucralose, aspartame, and saccharin. And while people often use them when cutting calories, there are possible health effects with all these things, of course. So there were some researchers from the Diabetes and Obesity Research Institute of the University of Southern California, and they conducted a study using magnetic resonance imaging, which is, you know, as MRI scans, to determine brain flow in the hypothalamus after consuming sucralose, sucrose, or water. The hypothalamus is a structure in the brain that's the absolute overlord. It oversees all of your hormonal functions in your body. So when there's increased hypothalamic blood flow, it suggests an increase in hunger signals in the brain. So that's how they link that. And the studies found that when these people consume sucralose, it can trigger strong hunger signals, potentially increasing appetite and leading to overeating when compared to sucrose and water. So my understanding from this is that the sucralose made you hungrier than sugar and water. Go figure. So on the one hand, it's non-caloric, but on the other hand, it makes you want to eat more. And it depends on what you're going to eat more. I mean, one of the things you want to do when you're trying to lose weight is eat less. And if you have a sugar substitute that makes you hungrier, that doesn't really work. So sucralose does affect brain flow. It's an artificial sweetener that, according to the existing research, it has a sweetness potency, wait for it, about 385 to 650 fold higher than sucrose, which is regular white sugar. The researchers examined how sucralose impacts people with a group of 75 adults aged 18 to 35 from three different weight categories: healthy, overweight, and obese. So those categories are based on the BMI. The BMI is the body mass index, which is a function of weight and height, and that's all it is. So you can be ripped, have lots of muscle mass, and be heavy, and have low body fat percentage, but you're considered to be overweight because your BMI, because it's just a function of weight and height, is high. So the BMI, if your BMI is less than 25, then you're considered to be of normal weight. If your BMI is between 25 and 29.99999, whatever, that's overweight. And that's where I am, in case you were wondering. And is it all muscle mass? No, it's not. I do have a good deal of muscle mass, but I also have mano belly, in case you were wondering. I might as well admit it because, if you see me, you could see that I have the mano belly. I am a person who is running a business and I sit too much. I do get plenty of exercise, but I probably eat too much sweet. And I sit a lot for my job. And until I sit less and can manage my food better, I am probably going to have the mano belly. And that's kind of how that goes. So anyway, so people who have a BMI of 30 to 34.99999, they are class 1 low-risk obesity. People from 35 to 39.99999, they are class 2 medium-risk obesity. And people who have a BMI of 40 and above are class 3 high-risk obesity. And I see people in all of those categories in my practice. Anyway, so what they found is that, they did this study on the people consuming the beverages. Participants underwent a baseline MRI scan and provided their hunger rating. After they finished the drink, the researchers collected more data after 10 minutes, 35 minutes, and 120 minutes. Once the researchers concluded all the sessions, they compared the MRI scans and the participants' reports to determine how sucralose impacts brain stimulating, or brain signaling, actually. And sucralose, so what they found, that sucralose not only increased blood flow in the hypothalamus compared to plain water, but also to sugar. So this indicates a stronger hunger-related brain response, which could lead to stimulating appetite rather than suppressing it. So that was the finding for the group as a whole. When breaking down responses among weight group and sex, the results then varied. People at healthy weights showed a stronger increase in hypothalamic activity after sucralose consumption than after sucrose. So if you're at a healthy weight and you're trying to keep at a healthy weight and you consume sucralose, you might be doing yourself a disservice because it's going to make you hungrier. People in the overweight category did not show significant differences in hypothalamic blood flow in response to any drink. For people with obesity, obesity is you have a BMI of 30 and above. Hunger-related brain activity increased after drinking sucralose compared to water, but not compared to regular sugar. So sugar and sucralose both increased their whole hypothalamic activity. People who were just plain overweight, it didn't make any difference whether it was water, sugar, or sucralose. Sucralose did not seem to significantly affect hunger responses in people who were overweight. The results suggest they may still significantly impact a large percentage of people in general. So when you take sex, gender into consideration, females showed a stronger response to sucralose over sucrose and water. The researchers believe that this supports the notion that women may have a stronger brain response to food cues. So the researchers also noted that their functional connectivity analysis showed that compared to table sugar, sucralose significantly increased coupling between the hypothalamus and the anterior cingulate cortex. This is significant because the anterior cingulate cortex impacts reward processing and can intensify your food cravings. So sucralose sweetened drinks made people hungrier. Taking a look at how participants rated their hunger levels at the start of the experiment, people reported similar hunger levels across all drink sessions. Their initial hunger was about the same, no matter which drink they're about to consume. However, the type of drink the participant drank affected how they rated their hunger afterward. The participants felt hungrier after consuming sucralose versus sugar, but didn't report this effect compared to drinking water. The researchers believe that sucralose does not trigger hormones to tell the body it is full. So it doesn't trigger your satiety hormones like your leptin. When the researchers noted that this area needs more research, the findings suggest that the non-caloric sweetener sucralose may inadvertently affect the brain and trigger hunger response. Considering that many people use the sweetener to avoid calories and lose weight, it's important to keep in mind when you make food and beverage choices, since sucralose has the potential to cause hunger and increase food intake. So could it impact clinical recommendations? So Mir Ali, who's a board-certified general surgeon and bariatric surgeon, medical director of Memorial Care Surgical Weight Loss, spoke with Medical News Today about the study. Based on the study, it seems that the brain processes non-caloric sweeteners to the same or greater extent than actual sugar. The studies may impact clinical recommendations. They already recommend that patients emphasize protein and non-starchy vegetables in the diet and minimize carbohydrates and sugars. After the study, he's also inclined to recommend minimizing non-caloric sweeteners as well. This could suggest that the brain expects energy from calories when eating something sweet. However, this expectation is not met when consuming non-caloric sweeteners like sucralose, which may prevent the processes within the hypothalamus that reduce appetite after eating something sweet from occurring the way they do when consuming calorie-containing sweeteners. So Whitaker said the study findings would not impact clinical recommendations at this time, since more research is needed, but it will impact mine. I am going to say to my patients, and I am saying to you now, if you are trying to lose weight and you're trying to decrease hunger, artificial sweeteners are probably not a good idea. And this particular study suggests directly that sucralose is not a good idea. So sucralose specifically. So where do you find sucralose? Sucralose you might find in, you find it in a lot of beverages. So watch for it in diet sodas. Watch for it in diet sport drinks. Watch for it in diet electrolytes. I did find it. I saw it when I was looking at the diet electrolytes when I went to the supermarket. It's definitely in there. This has no sucralose in it. It has stevia in it. Anyway, so, and I don't find that the stevia increases my hunger. So it may be a good idea to assess sucralose intake for someone who has made other dietary adjustments and is having a hard time reaching their weight goals. So sucralose, probably artificial sweeteners in general, and sucralose, there are some studies that indicate that sucralose does increase your hunger signals. It doesn't, and it will make you, the idea of, and I've heard this before, that artificial sweeteners will tend to, that they increase your expectation, the body's expectation, that it's going to receive calories. And when you, so artificial sweeteners, you're tasting sweet, so your body tastes that sweet and it says to the brain, you're going to get some calories soon. So your body prepares for it and it increases your ghrelin and it increases your hydrochloric acid and increases hormones that are going to go ahead and create digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid so that you can digest food. And that's going to cause you to be hungry. And if you're using an artificial sweetener because it's lower in calories, you may be at cross purposes because you're going to wind up eating more calories, even though the sucralose is probably not going to make you gain weight on its own. Like sucralose is non-caloric. That's the whole reason it's used. But it makes you hungrier, and it probably makes you hungrier than sugar. So if you have a craving for a Coke, you might as well have a little bit of Coke once in a while. That probably shouldn't have great big glasses of Coca-Cola every day. But if you're craving some kind of, a sweetened drink, you might as well have a little bit of taste of that and get it over with. And it's not going to make you as hungry as, because the body's going to actually get calories. I mean, it's not good for you. Products with high fructose corn syrup in it are not generally good for you. And products with excessive sugar in it are not good for you. But if you taste something sweet and there's actual sugar in it, then your body is actually getting the calories it's looking for. And your insulin will behave appropriately around that. I mean, if that's what you crave, if you crave some kind of a sweet drink, if you have it as part of a healthy meal that has like a lot of, like that doctor was saying, non-starchy vegetables and clean protein, then you might be able to handle a little bit of it. I mean, it's better to drink water. It's better to drink seltzer. It's better to drink fizzy water with a squeeze of fruit juice in it. And it's better to train yourself to have beverages that don't have sweetener in them. On the other hand, as we've talked about before, people will tend to drink more if they can taste carbohydrate in water. And the way to do that without wrecking your diet is to think about using electrolyte water that's sweetened with things like stevia or monk fruit, which are not going to make you hungrier. And also to train yourself to drink water with just actual fruit flavoring in them. So if you get fizzy water, you can squeeze lemon or lime into it or put fruit into it. You can get fizzy water that's already flavored, that has just flavoring in it, but no sweetener. And you can also get fizzy water that has a splash of fruit juice in it. There are brands that are low calorie because they have a small amount of fruit juice in them that you can taste. And it's a little more fun to drink than just plain water. So I have a variation of all of those. I happen to like to drink fizzy water that's unsweetened with fruit flavoring or squeeze my own lemon or both into it. And then I have the electrolytes that I flavored electrolytes that are sweetened with stevia. And that works for me. And I stay away from sucralose altogether. I try not to have anything that has sucralose in it. So think about that. That's an interesting thing. All right, so the next news item I came up with is less slow wave and REM sleep can increase Alzheimer's risk. So this is interesting. So spending less time in stage 2 deep sleep can contribute to Alzheimer's, which is, you know, a classic type of dementia where you look in the brain and you see increased neurofibrillary tangles and neuritic plaques and increased tau proteins. So earlier studies have identified a relationship between sleep and Alzheimer's disease. There's a new study that looks in detail at sleep phases, brain changes, and Alzheimer's disease. And according to the results, reductions in certain times of sleep are linked to reduced volume in brain areas involved in Alzheimer's. Understanding the risk factors associated with Alzheimer's disease is a hot topic. With few effective treatments and increased prevalence, taking steps to reduce risk is very important. So there are various sleep cycles. There's four phases of sleep. There's stage one, which is the first stage once you've dropped off. It's relatively light. Muscles begin to relax and only lasts for like 1 to 5 minutes. I didn't realize that your stage one sleep only lasts for 1 to 5 minutes. Stage two is slightly deeper, and this phase lasts around 25 minutes. The body relaxes further. Stage three is the deepest stage of sleep, and your heart rate, breathing, and brain waves become more regular. Stage three is also known as slow wave sleep, and then there's stage four. That's called REM, or rapid eye movement sleep, because of the movement of the eyes during this phase. During REM sleep, breathing becomes faster, and blood pressure and heart rate become less regular. And people generally cycle through these four phases 4 to 6 times per night. There's previous research that shows that aspects of sleep, like sleeping longer than normal or disturbed sleep, are associated with dementia and disease progression. However, until the latest study, the direct links between specific aspects of sleep architecture and Alzheimer's, specifically neuroanatomy associated with the disease, hadn't been studied in depth. So Alzheimer's is characterized by brain atrophy. That means that the brain is shrinking. According to authors of the study, some brain regions atrophy more than others. So those are going to be the hippocampus, the parahippocampal region, the entorhinal region, the inferior parietal region, the precuneus, and the cuneus regions. Along these Alzheimer's vulnerable brain regions, there are other factors associated, and that is cerebral microbleeds, that you get a little bit of bleeding in the brain. There are small bleeds within the brain and a sign of cerebral small vessel disease, which seem to be linked to Alzheimer's. The latest research explores the relationship between specific sleep phases and Alzheimer's vulnerable brain regions. And there was a study of 270 people in the Atherosclerosis Risk and Community Study where they use polysomnography. And polysomnography is that when you get a sleep study, polysomnography means that you go to sleep and you're hooked up to EEGs, and they measure your they measure what your brain waves do, and they also measure what's going on with your breathing. They use MRI to look at the anatomical features of the brain, like the brain volume and evidence of the microbleeds, 13 to 17 years later, and measured the proportion of slow wave sleep, the proportion of REM sleep, and how they experienced arousal at night. These scientists found that when you have less slow wave sleep, it was associated with a smaller inferior parietal region and cuneus, which are two of the regions that get affected in Alzheimer's disease. Similarly, when you have less REM sleep, that's linked to smaller inferior parietal regions and precuneus. After adjusting the analysis for errors, reductions in slow wave and REM sleep are most tightly associated with atrophy of the parietal region. And measures of arousal during sleep and microbleeds were not associated with the volume of any Alzheimer's vulnerable brain regions. Reduced slow wave and reduced REM sleep may raise your risk. According to the authors, this study is the first to examine the relationship of sleep architecture with atrophy of Alzheimer's vulnerable regions in older adults. The results of the study infer that reductions in slow wave and REM sleep might play a significant role in the reduction of volume in the inferior parietal region. Earlier research has showed that sleep helps to clear toxins from the brain. The authors suggest this might help explain why reductions in sleep might cause neurological atrophy, because there's toxins. What kind of toxins are in your brain? Well, it could be stuff that you've ingested. It could be stuff from food. It could be stuff that you've breathed in. And it also could be metabolic waste, simply because your brain undergoes metabolism just like every other place in your body. And if you don't get proper sleep, you're not going to be able to metabolize those toxins out. And though that metabolism happens, the big time that it happens is during REM sleep. So people with sleep apnea, now remember, stage one, I was today years old when I found this out. I didn't realize that stage one sleep is only 1 to 5 minutes long, that, and then you jump right into stage two. When does sleep apnea happen? Sleep apnea meaning that you stop breathing because you have something wrong with your breathing apparatus during sleep, that, you know, your palate goes backwards and you stop breathing, whatever the mechanisms for sleep apnea are. That happens in stage one sleep. So people with bad sleep apnea never get out of stage one. So sleep apnea is really bad for you. And this is one of the reasons why sleep apnea is really bad for you. Because you don't wind up getting your stage two, your stage three, or your REM sleep, and your brain becomes toxic. So you're not going to feel good. So if you are fighting the idea, whatever you need to do to not have sleep apnea, whether it's get surgery, whether it's wear a strip, whether it's get a CPAP, whether it's getting a BiPAP, whatever kind of mask you have to get, it's really important to fix sleep apnea. It's bad for you. And this is one of the reasons why. Sleep apnea increases your risk of stroke, and it increases your risk of heart attack as well. When you stop breathing like that and you don't get into your deeper stages of sleep, that cessation of breathing makes you more likely to have strokes and heart attacks. So that's how that works. But not getting into the stage two through REM stages of sleep makes it so your brain can't detox. So what do you then get? You have metabolic processes going on in your brain. You have oxidative damage, and therefore you have damage to the neurons in your brain. Getting those regular phases of sleep, two, three, and REM sleep, it's necessary to do so that your brain can detox. And that's why drinking a lot of water helps, taking antioxidants helps. One of there are studies on curcumin, for example. Curcumin is something that can protect the brain from oxidative damage. And then they always tell you to eat blackberries. So, well, it's not just blackberries. It's anything with anthocyanins in it, those wonderful, deeply pigmented fruits and vegetables. So your blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, pomegranates, cherries, blueberries, all those deeply colored fruits, and vegetables too. Any purple vegetables, your eggplant and your purple squash, your purple potatoes, anything purple or red is gonna. So the red and orange and yellow stuff is often going to have it's gonna have carotenoids in it, and those are wonderful antioxidants too. And then the pink and purple stuff, you know, deep pink and purple stuff, like your pomegranates and all your berries and cherries, they have anthocyanins in them. They're wonderful antioxidants. And they get into your brain and protect brain neurodegeneration. Curcumin does that too, and so does green tea. So all of those things. So getting lots of antioxidants on board from all kinds of sources is really, whether you take it in pills and whether you eat it, both of those are going to help you. So I should be sipping on pomegranate juice as I'm talking to you. So earlier research has shown that sleep clears toxins. Medical research talked to Chelsea Rorscheib, who's a sleep expert and neuroscientist at Wesper, who was not involved in the study, and asked why changes in sleep architecture might have influenced brain atrophy and Alzheimer's. Sleep has many crucial biological functions and is especially important for cell and tissue repair, brain maintenance, learning and memory. It's kind of like when you call off the cars on the highway, you can get on the highway and do repair. So if you're not actively using your brain, which is what you're doing when you're asleep and you're not conscious, your brain can actually pick up the highway repair. It can do the repair in the brain. And you have to sleep well in order for that to happen. So the other thing that happens is that memories become integrated into, you know, how computers do backup at night. Well, guess what? Your brain does the same thing. When you're sleeping, all the memories you had for things that happened during the day get backed up into your long-term memory. And so having good sleep, you need good sleep to have that happen as well. So learning and memory and cognition, that's why sometimes you'll learn something on a given day and then you're having trouble putting it together, or maybe you learned a dance, or maybe you learned a topic, or maybe you learned something in a language and you don't have it down so well when you go to sleep. And the next day when you try it, you're like, oh, and you've picked it up. Well, something got stored in your long-term memory while you were doing your nice sleep. Great how that happens, right? So most of the functions occur during stage 3 slow wave sleep and REM sleep. All of the processes are crucial for maintaining brain health and reducing the risk of Alzheimer's disease. So Rothschild told us that Alzheimer's disease is characterized by a buildup of junk proteins in the brain. The proteins are normally removed by a waste removal system that occurs during stage 4 slow wave sleep called the glymphatic system. So I think the glymphatic system is the glial cells. That's why it's gl and not l, lymphatic. People who are chronically sleep deprived and spend less time in slow wave sleep don't clear their brains effectively. So Leah Kaler, PhD, who's a licensed psychologist specializing in sleep, was not involved in the research. She delved a little more detail. While you're sleeping, the brain shrinks. Every night it shrinks a bit, creating more space for cerebrospinal fluid to flood the areas where the brain's waste products accumulate. The fluid acts as a car wash, clearing out the toxins, misfolded proteins, and debris that have built up through the day, ensuring that our brain functions at its peak. So as I said, the toxins could be stuff in your brain that's not supposed to be there, stuff you breathed in, maybe a chemical you breathed in while you were cleaning, or something you breathed in from the environment, or maybe you're using a shampoo that you shouldn't be that has a protein in it that should has a scent in it that's actually a chemical. And it's also generally in your brain, your cells are always making mistakes. And if they don't make too many mistakes, your body has ways to clear that up. So you get misfolded proteins. So you're always breaking down and rebuilding tissue all over your body, including in your brain. So some proteins genetically are wrong. So you get these misfolded proteins. They have to be got rid of too. And debris is going to be, you have metabolic processes going on. You have oxidative stress. You have all kinds of components that are created because of metabolism in the brain. And they have to be gotten rid of too. So your brain will shrink a bit and you'll be bathed with cerebrospinal fluid. And it's like it's like the tide, that you have low tide during the day so your brain can do its thing and is not overwhelmed with cerebrospinal fluid. And then you have high tide at night where the cerebrospinal fluid comes in and it washes out the toxins. Very interesting stuff. One of the waste products is beta amyloid, also tau proteins. Beta amyloid and tau proteins are increased in Alzheimer's disease. And so when you sleep good and you get that ocean of cerebrospinal fluid coming in, it washes out those proteins and then you excrete them other ways from the body. So how important are these results? If you examine a cohort over 13 to 17 years, the research provides a longitudinal perspective on how sleep architecture impacts brain structure over time. This is important because it strengthens evidence for causal relationships. Although the results of the study certainly are intriguing, there needs to be more research. So how are you going to get better sleep? You've heard me talk about this endlessly. Keep a consistent sleep schedule, which lets you get 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night, including on the weekends. Have a pre-bedtime routine, which involves winding down, putting away electronics, including TV, at least 1 hour before bed. Keep your room cool, dark, and comfortable. You want it to be at a temperature that works for you. For me, that's on the cool side. Not as cool for Ron, but because he doesn't have the body fat that I have, and he's not postmenopausal. I sleep better when the room is reasonably cool. And if you have chronic sleep troubles, get it fixed. Get diagnosed for sleep apnea and get that taken care of. Cut out caffeine 10 hours before bed. That's interesting. So if you go to bed at 9, that's 11 o'clock in the morning. So that means if you're going to do caffeine, cut it off at 11 in the morning. And depending what time you go to bed, you have to count back 10 hours. So if you go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, that's noon. So no caffeine. So if you'd say, I'm only going to have my caffeine in the morning and I don't have it afterwards. Now, if you are very, very sensitive to caffeine, you may have to cut back your caffeine altogether. And I have to talk to people about this because they're so used to thinking of caffeine as a routine and as a food that they're unwilling to give it up. And I explained to them, listen, you're telling me you're not sleeping. Does it make sense to put something into your body that specifically prevents sleep? It promotes wakefulness. It doesn't make any sense. You're going to sleep better if you don't have that on board. also don't drink or eat anything too close to bedtime. I mean, you can sip on water or calming tea if you want to. But finish your last meal of the day and no more alcohol 3 hours before bed. We don't always make it to there, but that's a good practice to have. You're going to go to bed at 11 o'clock, be done with dinner and any eating by 8 o'clock. Calm down, settle down. 2 hours before you go to bed, begin to shift gears mentally, wind down, and leave the stress of the day behind. So don't, like, work on stuff right up to bedtime. That's really not good to do. And unfortunately, people in school who are studying stuff, that's hard to do because, you know, studying is something. I remember when I was in school and I had to study for stuff, I would do it in the evening. I'm so fortunate that those days are behind me. And, you know, I will read things during the course of my work day, but I don't tend to do anything heavy, you know, anything that I have to learn something before bedtime. And, you know, I will have a yearly conference, and during the conference, you know, of course, depending on what's going on at the conference, I might or might not be studying something before bed, but you try to put that aside before bed. And then expose yourself to sunlight during the day. That also means on a cloudy day, just at least stand in your yard or look outside. It's very good for you to expose yourself to sunlight, and even have a window in your bedroom. It's one of the most effective ways to strengthen your circadian rhythm, which is your sleep-wake cycle. So the study adds to our understanding of the relationship between sleep architecture, brain atrophy, and Alzheimer's. So this is very interesting. So the take home here is, if you have trouble with sleep, you want to get it taken care of. Figure out what your trouble with your sleep is and get it fixed, because sleep literally will lead you down the path to dementia and possibly Alzheimer's disease. And so if you do have sleep apnea, it's important to get that taken care of. You know, if you think that you're waking up unrefreshed every day, it's probably, and you haven't figured it out quite yet, it's probably a good idea to see a pulmonologist and get yourself a sleep study and figure out if you do need some kind of a device to help you to sleep better. And there are other ways you can do that. Improve your sleep. If you are very heavy, or if you do have respiratory problems, if you have asthma, or if you have respiratory allergies, get those taken care of, because they will interfere. They'll make you snore. You may not have sleep apnea, but snoring can interfere with your sleep. So make sure that's good. And part of sleep hygiene is making sure there aren't allergens that you're allergic to in your bedroom. So if you have dusty mattresses, you know, you want to make sure your sheets are clean, and at least change your pillowcases a couple of times a week, so you're getting rid of the dust and mold that are on your pillowcases. So getting regular sleep. The take-home is getting regular sleep and getting good sleep, 7 to 9 hours of night, and going through all of your cycles, stages 1, 2, 3, and REM, help to prevent dementia. So it's worth doing, and it's worth working on. Okay, so let's go on to something else. So let's talk about I want to get back into some menopause and nutrition stuff. So that's probably how we'll finish out today. So yeah, there's been some research that's saying that higher carbs tend to be better for menopause, and I think I'm going to have to pick that up. I'm going to have to pick that up next week. So let's go to, let me talk to you about the Galveston diet for a few minutes. So the Galveston diet is Galveston is a town on the coast in Texas. So Texas has a coast. I don't think about going to the beach in Texas, because I think of it as being a place where there's lots of stretches of desert. But no, Texas is on the Gulf of Mexico, because, I mean, your geography goes, let me see if I get this right. It goes Florida, Alabama, and I know Florida and Alabama because I think Jimmy Buffett has a song about Florabama something or other. So Florida, then Alabama. Then next to Alabama is Mississippi. Next to Mississippi is Louisiana. And then, of course, Louisiana borders on Texas. And all of these places have a Gulf Coast. And Texas is the final Gulf Coast. And, of course, the Texas coast goes all the way down and then has a border with Mexico. Anyway, so Texas is on the Gulf of Mexico and has the beach. And I never really thought about it. Corpus Christi is a beach town. So is Galveston. Galveston, oh, Galveston. That's Glenn Campbell's song. All right. So the Galveston Diet is a weight loss program that's aimed at middle-aged menopausal women. Am I still middle-aged? I'm 61. Am I getting into elderly or am I still middle-aged? I think it depends who you ask. So the Galveston Diet doesn't look at simple calorie restriction. It emphasizes the importance of when to eat, what to eat, and what foods to avoid to reduce inflammation in your body. So the eating pattern is ultimately a 16-8 intermittent fasting regimen combined with a high-fat, low-carb, and inflammation-fighting food diet. So I didn't realize there was an intermittent fasting piece to this. They review on whether it's helpful for weight loss. And they're saying it's a very low-carb diet program that promotes eating whole foods and foods shown to help fight inflammation. And so what you do with it, it was created by Mary Claire Haver, who's a board-supported OBGYN. She developed the idea behind the diet as she was attempting to lose weight after going through menopause and also grieving the loss of her brother. After struggling to lose weight by eating less and exercising more, she realized that calories in versus calories out was incomplete. So she based the diet on the notion that your weight is primarily affected by your hormones, which there's a lot of diet plans that are based on hormones. And hormones are affected by the calories, the quality of the food you eat. So the Galveston diet emphasized the quality of the foods you eat and when you eat them rather than calorie cutting. So that's nice, because when you have to think about calories, it can make you pretty nutty. So the Signature program is intended for middle-aged women to lose weight and adopt a healthier lifestyle. And there's a Prime program that's nutrition-based wellness for young adults. And they also involve some dietary supplements. And the Signature program is online, and it's something that you can pay for. Anyway, it does incorporate 16-8 intermittent fasting. And I'm not a huge fan of intermittent fasting, especially for postmenopausal women. I think intermittent fasting can be too stressful. And the studies on intermittent fasting were done on young men. So if you read Stacey Sims and you read Celine Yeager, women who are athletes who talk about fitness and nutrition for postmenopausal women, and perimenopausal women, they're not big on intermittent fasting. That they need you have to feed your hunger, and you eat when you're hungry and you don't eat when you're not. And that's what I believe in. But this does promote the intermittent fasting, and it's the 16-8 window where you eat all your calories within an 8-hour window and then fast for 16 hours. During the fasting window, you don't consume any calories. Zero-calorie beverages like plain water, unsweetened tea, and unsweetened coffee are allowed. So the interesting thing about that is when I talk to people about intermittent fasting, I don't say zero calories, because it's not about zero calories. It's about not raising your insulin. So if you consume MCT oil or if you consume bone broth, those have calories in them, but you can have them during the fasting window because they don't raise your insulin. If they don't raise your insulin, then there's no reason not to have them. And if they make you feel a little bit less hungry, then that's useful. So when you limit the time that you're allowed to eat, you tend to eat fewer calories which promotes weight loss. In addition to promoting weight loss, intermittent fasting has been linked to other benefits, including reduced inflammation, improved insulin resistance. Again, so the idea of fasting, so having this long fast, it's similar to getting to sleep. What do you do when you sleep? Your brain is not actively doing stuff, so it's passively doing stuff, so it can clear the highway. Likewise, when you're not eating, if you're just drinking water or drinking only nourishing substances like MCT oil or like bone broth, because bone broth is structural. Your body's not going to use it for calories. It's going to use it to rebuild your body. So that's why it's I think it's generally okay to have it while you're in the fasting zone. And same with MCT oil, your body's going to use it for energy, but it doesn't raise insulin. So when you're eating is offline, again, there's no cars going through the highway, your body can do a lot of repair. So you can do a lot of repair to your GI, and you're not being affected by spikes and drops in insulin, that your insulin's going to tend to be low all that time. And so that is one of the mechanisms by which there's less inflammation, because insulin will stimulate inflammatory compounds. So then you eat anti-inflammatory nutrition. Inflammation is a normal immune response. When you have acute or short-term inflammation, it's important for fighting infection and healing wounds. But low-grade chronic inflammation is associated with obesity, cancer, arthritis, and heart disease. A study of over 20,000 people tied low-grade chronic inflammation to 44% higher risk of all-cause mortality over 5 years. So getting your inflammation down is important. And the Galveston diet encourages the intake of foods like vegetables and fruit, which are rich in plant compounds. Then there's the fuel refocus. The Galveston diet's ultimately a high-fat, low-carb diet. It resembles the standard keto diet in its macronutrient distribution, as most daily calories come from fat. And an average American diet comprises about 35% calories from fat, 16% from protein, and 47% from carbs. Whereas Galveston, they want you to get 70% of your calories from fat, 20% from protein, and 10% from carbs. The idea behind this shift is to get most of your calories from fat instead of carbs. What the diet refers to is fuel refocus. In general, carbs are your body's preferred energy source, yet under low-carb conditions, like fasting or low-carb diets, your body will break down fat for energy. High-fat keto diets are generally more effective for weight loss than low-fat diets for some people. I think if you're doing a keto diet and you're doing an intermittent fasting and it's working for you, that's great. My experience is, in my practice, is that very low-carb diets and high-fat diets are not sustainable. Most people don't want to do them. They do it for a while and then they stop because it's just not sustainable and it's not fun. And people get very hungry on them. Although some people do really well. And then if you're a person who does great on a ketogenic diet, you do this Galveston diet, you do great, and you're doing intermittent fasting, whatever your gender is, and you do fantastically well, you feel good, you have good energy, and you get to a weight that you're happy with, by all means. But my experience is that most people don't handle it well, that they go off it, that the compliance is not good. So what they have you eat fats like olive oil, coconut oil, MCT oil, butter, ghee, avocado oil, and sesame oil, protein like lean chicken, ground beef, turkey, eggs, lean pork, salmon, trout, tuna, and shellfish, avocado, strawberries, blueberries, and raspberries, leafy greens, other vegetables like cruciferous vegetables, tomatoes, bell peppers, nuts like cashews, pistachios, almond, and peanuts, seeds like pumpkin, sesame, sunflower, flax, and chia. They do have you have dairy, and the dairy is heavy cream, cheese, sour cream, plain Greek yogurt, and nut milk. Tea, like black, green, anything from Camellia sinensis, as well as chamomile, and then fresh herbs. They have you limit or avoid added sugar, artificial sweeteners, food additives, alcohol, processed food like refined grains, fried foods, and processed meats, vegetables, hot oils that are high in omega-6 fats like soybean, sunflower, safflower, and corn oil, and sugar-sweetened beverages, sweet tea, cola, soft drinks, and juice. During menopause, we become more prone to abdominal weight gain because of hormonal shifts, and abdominal obesity, including waist size, is one of the risk factors that increase your risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and stroke. Although Galveston has yet to be researched specifically, the intermittent fasting and low-carb dieting have been studied for their weight loss, and 16:8 intermittent fasting can help reduce belly fat and cut waist size by like 2.1 inches. There is another study on men, again, men. The group followed intermittent fasting, experienced 53% more weight loss than a traditional calorie-restricted diet. And in women who were overweight, showed that doing a 5-2 intermittent fasting diet, that means 5 days normal eating, 2 days fasting, were more successful in achieving weight loss than if they just did calorie restriction. So it may help fight inflammation. Chronic inflammation, of course, can contribute to cardiovascular disease. And research indicates that low-carb diets can reduce inflammation, help to prevent Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis, and may reduce overall disease risk, and also healthy blood sugar management. The downsides that it's potentially low in fiber. Not everybody's going to go to the bathroom every day. And high fiber diets have an 18 to 23% lower risk of death. So that's why I wonder about it. And that's why I push the Mediterranean diet more than I push diets like this. People on extremely low carb diets find them restrictive and may be unable to follow it long term. Some people will, a lot of people won't. That's kind of how it works. The diet hasn't been studied specifically. It is a low-carb intermittent fasting program that provides nutrition education and meal prep guidance. And if you join, you can join it, and you can also just get the book and follow what it says in the book. If you follow everything but the intermittent fasting piece, you'll probably lose weight. And the thing is, if you mostly get rid of refined carbohydrates and you eat a lot of fiber and you don't worry so much about your macros, but you do like have protein at every meal and have protein and non-starchy vegetables at every meal, and then you add in small amounts of the other things around it and don't worry so much about the intermittent fasting and eat when you're hungry and don't eat when you're not, you're probably going to do well. I will give patients my intermittent fasting handout and tell them, you know, you may or may not want to do the intermittent fasting part, but all the other advice is helpful. And I'm not, quite honestly, a fan of very low carbohydrate diets. I am a fan of them for people for whom they work very well and are happy with them. But I'm not a fan of them for most people. I'm not a fan of it for me because it doesn't work for me. And in my experience, as it says here, most people don't want to stay on them. They don't have good compliance. All right, so that's all I got for you today. We'll be back next week with more. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores and WHUS.org.